Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Robin Mayer from Little Robin Designs. Robin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Beth and Gary. I am really excited to have this chat today.
Well, we are too, and I think we're more excited about the money we're going to spend, or I'm not sure what.
This is again another costly podcast for us. Yep. But that's all right. That's all right. We're here for the community.
I'm here to give you any kind of support in that you need.
Thanks.
Beth, I think you just put it in the framework of a sacrifice for the people, for the good of the people.
That's what I think it is. You don't think that's the our
cause? I'm feeling pretty good about myself right at the moment. Yeah. A sacrifice for the good of the people.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Uh-huh. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yep. Okay, Robin, gotta ask right out of the gate. You know, always watch what's when you take a picture of yourself, what's behind you. And so the picture you sent of you, talk about, you got behind you, looks like Beth suggested it's a curtain rod or a shower curtain rod with all your threads hanging on it. What are you doing there?
It's a small curtain rod. And then I have all of my designer palettes on the cards they come on binder rings, and then you put the binder rings on the curtain rod. So for my designer palettes, I just leave them on their cards. For my personal stash, like my DMC and my hand dyes and my silks, I put those all on Annie's Keepers, and they either get the same treatment. I've got a couple small cafe rods on the back of my door. My DMC is there, and then I keep my hand dyes and my silks in a couple of file totes, because the Annie's Keepers come with these slider storage system that has hooks on the ends that just hook right over like a file folder. And so you can just put all of your threads in there, and then you close it, and it's lightproof, waterproof, protected. So that is what I do.
Annie's Keepers?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, they're like clear plastic, and you can put like a little round label on them that you write whatever the color is on it. But they're a lot thicker than some of the other ones that you see, and they've got a groove in them so that you can use that file system that they also sell.
Okay.
I started using them years and years and years and years ago, and so that's just what I prefer. But I keep the designer ones next to me just so that I can look at them and pet them, and they're pretty, and the colors inspire me.
Right.
And then they're right there if I'm like, yeah, this red isn't really working, I need a different one, and so I can just pull them off right off the rod and test out different ones as I sit here at my desk.
Yeah. Well, see, you know, I mean, organizational people tell you that stuff you use all the time is always to be within arm's reach. And then
yes,
you move things away according to how often you use them. So for you, that would be spot on.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a big help.
Cause I'm thinking about redoing, cause my room is, the storage is not proper, and I forget that I have things because they're stored away. So I'm thinking about redoing it. And so what you have hanging there gave me ideas. And then I think about Beth and her inventory.
And yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen people use, like, if people don't want to invest in the Annie's Keepers, because they are a little bit of an investment, but, you know, just like cardstock. Business card size cardstock, and just the, you know, the floss drops that they come on, that Weeks and all of them come on, yeah, work just fine, you know.
I like your curtain rods though too, because I have a closet that's not well utilized, and I think that it'd be better to put another rod in there to hang more things.
Mm-hmm.
That way I can see them, but they'd be covered. It has a door on it, so it's not going to get light. It's in the basement. It doesn't see light. So,
right.
But another rod would be nice to have. So mm-hmm. it'd be easier to see. All I have to do is open the door and there's my inventory.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? So if the rod you have, does it have like a shelf on it?
Yes, there's a shelf above it.
Yeah, so you could, I mean, just go to Home Depot and get another one that has, you know, you can hang and it has a shelf on it, and then you have a shelf and, you know, your threads hanging below the shelf with, you know, charts or whatever you've got on the shelf, and
right,
do a few layers deep of that, and you have like a whole wall of storage.
Right, right. Instead of just stuff in there that's, you know, you have to pull out to find that's in.
Mm-hmm.
Boxes, it'd be easier if it were hanging or something else. It's just, yeah.
Right. Because see, I think that's, you know, that's it is like for me, you know, I know I have this thread somewhere. It's either here or over here or in this box.
Yeah. And you're in six different places looking for it.
Yes. And half a day later, you find it.
And you're like, okay, well, now I'll do whatever I needed to do with it tomorrow because it's midnight now.
Right.
And that's my bedtime.
See, okay, so taking a closet and multiple rods in a closet, because like you suggested, Beth, one of the concerns I have is having threads out where light can get to them and or dust, and so I like them put away. And so if it's in a closet where you can close the doors, but they're all on display when you open, that's,
Yeah.
I think you might want to get a chair because you're going to want to just sit in the doorway of the closet and look at the pretties.
Yeah, there's that.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. My wheels are spinning here. There's ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now you're really costing us money.
Yeah.
I live to serve.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you.
All right, so back to the beginning when you started, you mentioned about potholder weaving. I remember those things.
You know, and they still have them.
Yep.
I saw them at Michael's a few weeks ago. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, they do, because there's a place here in St. Louis called MADE, M-A-D-E, where kids can come and just do all kinds of crafts. It's really an excellent facility. And the first time I went with our grandsons, they had those. And I picked one up, and the oldest grandson, Cooper, I'm sure he was amazed because I sat right down. I knew exactly what to do. And he just, you know, he was watching me, and can you show me? Yeah, I made 100 of these things when I was a kid. Yeah,
they'd come with that bag of like 100 loops and the little frame and or 1,000 loops, whatever. Excuse me. Yeah. Yeah, my grandmother got that for my brother and I. We used to go and spend the summers with my mother's parents. They had a farm in Michigan. And then my dad's parents lived in, very near Detroit. And so we would go to the farm for the summer, but then spend a week and a half, 2 weeks with my other grandparents. So they would always, you know, when we got there, they would always go and get things for us to do, you know, whether it was coloring books or another game or... One year it was those little rag pot holder kits. And so we would sit there and, you know, when my grandmother was, you know, knitting or embroidering or whatever it was she happened to be doing, we would do that.
Yeah. Now she was the creative one, right?
She was. She did everything. She knitted, she crocheted, she embroidered. She did cross stitch, but mostly it was embroidery if she was, you know, doing a surface work. She did sew a lot. She and my grandfather square danced, and she made all of their costumes. So I remember going in their basement, and she had all, you know, the petticoats were just huge, many, many layers of petticoats. And she would have them hanging from the rafters in the basement. It was kind of like, so it was like looking up at these, at the tool petticoats.
Yep. Oh, that is so wild because my aunt and uncle square danced a lot. And actually hanging right in front of me on the wall, I acquired it when she passed away, is a Roto magazine.
Uh-huh.
R-O-T-O magazine. Anyway, they got on the cover. And she used to make all her dresses, and yeah, I had all those petticoats that made them stick out 8 feet. And
yeah, that is so cool. What a coincidence.
Yeah. Yep. No, looking right in front of me here is there they are. And my uncle is was a retired a Navy officer and an engineer, and you know, very stiff-shirted, if you will, you know, just very serious about everything. And the thought of him square dancing with her was, she must have had to twist his arm, I'll tell you.
Maybe not. Maybe it was, you know, his one opportunity to kick loose and just be free.
Yep. Right here in front of me. So that's so wild. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Very cool.
So your grandmother got you hooked? Is that was the gateway drug?
Yes, that was definitely the gateway drug. She showed me how to, you know, the little finger chains that you would make with the yarn. Mm-hmm. She showed me how to do that. We did the pot holders. She showed me a little bit of crochet. And so that was definitely the, like you said, the gateway drug. And then in high school, I started, my mom, there's a store called MJ Designs in our area. We lived in the DC area at that time. And we would go there every weekend. I don't know really what my mom was looking for, but I would kind of wander off. And I started seeing the cross-stitch kits and mostly the needlepoint kits. I didn't really like the cross-stitch kits that were on offer. And so I just kept seeing them. And then in high school, I finally bought one for myself. It was a little chickadee in a fall tree. I made it. I stitched it in. You know, I used to sit in the choir room for lunch with all the other choir nerds and eat my lunch. And then I would needlepoint for a little while. And I did eventually finish it. I don't think it took very long. I gave it to my dad. I don't know what happened to it. I would love to know. It probably got lost in one of the moves, you know.
Yeah.
And then in college, we went to a Hallmark and they had a pillow kit, and I bought that. And I remember I was with my roommate and my boyfriend and my roommate's boyfriend, and they were all just like making so much fun of me. Oh my gosh, you're an old lady. And I'm like, look, y'all, I don't even care. So I bought it and I finished it, and I still have it. I need to retrim it because the trimming is coming off. I've been saying that for like 3 years. But,
that's so interesting because of that reaction from your friends, that, you know, people who actually stick to it and stitch through school, because it's kind of a misfit in the culture.
Yes.
Yeah. But you just enjoyed it enough that you just stuck to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like the process. I like the feel of the tension of the thread, you know, whether it's wool or cotton or silk, pulling through the canvas or the linen, even the, you know, I have one project going that's on Lugana, and I really kind of like the stretch that the Lugana has. It feels different and nice. I don't know. I guess I'm a really tactile person, and so I really love the process and the end result. It's very satisfying.
Did it help you in terms of a diversion at school?
No. And in fact, in school, I was really, really, really busy. I worked 3 jobs. I finished a year ahead. And so, you know, I mean, it wasn't something I spent a lot of time doing, but, you know, once in a while when I had a break, it was nice to have it to sit down and just, I don't know, it's very absorbing to me. I can sit there. I usually will listen to an audiobook or watch a movie or, you know, binge watch a series on TV, but I can also just sit in silence and listen to the pull of the thread, and I love it.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. It is relaxing, and there's just, I haven't ever found any other hobby or any other craft or art that's like doing needlework.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it, I don't know if it's the rhythmic nature of the the movement and the sound. I can't put my finger on what exactly it is that, you know, you can just feel your blood pressure drop.
Yes.
You know, it's so therapeutic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's nice to have something when you're done, too. You know,
yes.
It might take me forever, but, you know, to have something when you're done that you can say, hey, I made this.
Yes. You can be meditative and productive at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. So did you make your way through different techniques, or because you said you didn't care much for the cross stitch initially, but now here look at you today. Yeah.
Well, what I just didn't like the types of things that were on offer. Like, you know, it was either the duck, you know, the geese with the bows around their necks. I'm really dating myself. Or the wizards on a mountain with lightning all around. I was like not into that. And that's what was available for cross stitch. And the needlepoint kits were a little more my speed. But what I really intensely disliked about needlepoint, and honestly, why I haven't gone back to the, you know, painted on canvas needlepoint, is, you know, you have a square that is painted half green and half red, and you're like, well, which thing am I supposed to put in here? I need to know very precisely where everything is supposed to go. And so, you know, that is what appealed to me about cross stitch. Well, I wish, you know, needlepoint was like cross stitch in that way. And then one of the ladies I worked with also did dimensions kits, or, you know, did dimensions kits. And I saw her working on one day at lunch, and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. You know, I don't know that I really, you know, that's not my thing. That's not my type of art, but I really love the cross stitch, and I love the, you know, preciseness. You know exactly where you're supposed to put every stitch. And another lady said, oh, well, I do cross stitch too, but I do mine on linen. And here, I'll bring in my project. And so she brought in this whip of a beautiful blue crab on linen. And I'm like, what on earth is that? Where did you get that? Did you make that pattern? Like, what? Like, no, I didn't make that. She's like, go to 123stitch.com. And I did, and my mind was blown. And so it took me a little while to get my first chart after that, because my daughter was born, and but then she was about a year old, and I finally went and got my first cross-stitch kit, and that was, you know, just to try it out. It was a little sheep, so still one of those cutesy things. But I loved it. I loved it. And that's all she wrote.
Hooked forever. Yep.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think back when, you know, those days when there were cross stitch stores every 50 feet, and some of the, I mean, of course, from a male perspective, it's like, really, you want, I'm not stitching any of that stuff. Because, yeah, I know what you mean. All the cutesy little ducks and things, and it was just, kit after kit. And dimension kits. Oh, man, I wonder how many thousands of those were sold.
Oh, my goodness. Jeez. Well, you know, they still sell very well, and a lot of them are very beautiful. I have a whole collection of Christmas dimensions kits. Now, will I ever stitch them? Probably not. But they're there. They're there if I ever get around to it. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, they made a boatload of them. Yeah, still do, yeah. I haven't looked at one in years. I don't know.
Yeah, there's some nice ones. I mean, there are. I know I've looked at them, but I remembered that it was the whole precious moments.
That's the one I was trying to think of.
Yes.
Oh, Jesus, things were everywhere.
Yes, and the boys' bears.
Yes, those, yes. In fact, I have two baby quilts. I might have three. I don't know if we made one for my daughter, Rachel, but I know my two boys, we made... on Ada, my friend stitched a little bit, one of those, either a Boyd's Bear or a Precious Moments, and then I made it into a quilt. So now I'm dating myself. But yeah, I remember those. Oh.
Yep. Precious Moments. Holy smokes.
It's come. Oh, and there was Precious Moments Everything, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, everything. Yeah.
That was ubiquitous.
Yeah, whoever owned it, owned the franchise, I hope they made a lot of money out of it.
Bet they did.
Yeah.
I bet they did.
Yeah. So when did the designing start? When did you make that move?
It was the fall of 2020, and I had done a little bit earlier in the year of making those thread drops, not the thread drops, what do you call it? The floss, thread keepers, floss keepers, you know, the little glass and metal cabochon, you know, the glass cabochon and the metal bezel, and you put a picture in there.
Yeah, I call them floss jewelry, but yes, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
There you go, mm-hmm. Bling.
Bling!
I did that for a few months, but it just wasn't really my thing. It was just a little bit, it felt a little bit assembly line-ish, and so I just said, well, you know, something will come up that I want to do, and Brenda, I watched Brenda and the Serial Starter, and she started talking in one of her videos about her collection of antiques, and I was like, huh, I don't think I'd ever just collect the antiques to collect the antiques, but I wonder if designing would be something that I should do. And so then I started thinking about it. So it was kind of a whim, but then I started thinking about all of the different things that I've done in my life, you know, my previous jobs, my previous hobbies, stitching, you know, and how all of those things would really fit into being the one person that does it all for a business that's centered around cross stitch and reproduction. And I really like challenging myself. I really like to always be learning, always learn something, you know, always be learning something new, right? Push your boundaries. And I decided, you know, this might be a really good way to do that. And so I talked to my husband about it, and I said, okay, well, this is what I want to do, and, you know, this is how much I want to spend to just test the waters, see if I even like it. And he said, absolutely, go for it. And so I did that. I bought 3 samplers. I paid way too much for one of them.
I bet that's easy to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And a couple others were a real steal. And so I did that first one was a sampler in blue and green, and that was actually an adaptation. And I was so excited that I had, you know, that I had a chart that I didn't even take a proper photo. I didn't frame it. I didn't take a really good photo of it. I just popped that puppy into a PDF and slapped it on my Etsy shop. I was like, there we go. And things got better after that.
Now, when you started this thing, were you working a full-time job and that you gave up to do this?
No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. No, I had quit working when I was pregnant with my son. He is just turned 8 and didn't go back. I also have a daughter who just left the nest last summer. And
we call that off the payroll.
Yeah. So I've been an at-home mom for about 9 years. Yeah. So I was just kind of, you know, not that you're bored, because that is not boring. It's not busy. But, you know, like I said, I like flexing my mental muscles, and I wanted to see if it was something that was feasible and enjoyable, and it was. It definitely was. Since then, I've started homeschooling my son, so we're a little busier than we were when I started it, but it's all to the good.
Ooh, yeah. Homeschooling, talk to Beth. Yeah.
Yeah, it's challenging, but it's an enjoyable challenge.
Definitely.
So good days, bad days, but in the end, I'll tell you, it's all worth it.
Yes.
So it was the samplers that got you started in the design?
It was.
It wasn't your own designs. Okay.
No. Mm-mm. It was the samplers for sure. And, you know, I talked to Kathy Haberman kindly. I reached out to her shortly after I put out that first chart and said, you know, hey, can I pick your brain a little bit about this whole thing and how this all works? And she said, sure. And so we set up a time to talk, and we ended up on the phone for, I don't know, I think it was about a 3-hour conversation, that first talk. And she really encouraged, she's like, listen, I know you love the samplers, but I would really encourage you, stretch yourself, do some originals. And, you know, I kind of pushed back against that for a while. And then I was like, well, I don't have any ideas. I'm not creative. She's like, what? And she goes, well, just, you know, she recommended a book about, you know, being an artist. I think it's called Steal Like an Artist. And so I read, you know, I got the book and I read that and I started thinking about it and from a different perspective, you know, the creative process and whether or not a person is creative or not. And, you know, is that a muscle that you can develop? And I decided to give it a shot. And so that fall, so it would be August of 21, I participated in the Needlework Expo online with Janice Note. Mm-hmm. And I had my first original that was the autumnal sampler. And it was, people really loved it. People still love it. I still get orders for it, and shops still buy it. And I see, you know, I see it pop up on Instagram. So that was encouraging to me. And so I just kind of, I kept going and did some research on, you know, how do artists organize themselves and, you know, have an actual process, right? I'm very much process oriented. You do this and you do this and you do this, and that leads to this result. And so I did a bunch of research on what that looks like for an artist or for a creative person. And I've been doing that. Like, I keep a little notebook that has ideas in it. So whenever a conversation sparks an idea or a quote, I'll just, you know, write it down. And if I have some kind of visual image in my mind related to that, I'll write that in there with it. And then I just sort of let it sit in the book and sit in my brain and marinate for a while until I have what I think is a complete design. And then I usually go to Procreate and draw it out. And then I'll take that over to WinStitch and translate it into a chart.
So there's,
and that's the process.
So there's some art talent in your genes here, it sounds like.
Yes, my grandfather and my aunt on my mother's side were amazing artists. I mean, both of them could draw anything, literally anything, and neither of them had any formal training at all. I mean, it would blow your mind to see the thing, like, you'd be like, oh, can you draw me, you know, a horse on a mountain, and, you know, 20 minutes later, it's the most detailed mountain scene with a horse you've ever seen in your entire life. You're like, what is that? But I am not naturally gifted in that way. I've had to be very disciplined in practice. In fact, some of the art units that I do with my son, I'm there right next to him doing it too.
Does it get easier?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, a little bit. I think what's gotten easier has been translating a fleeting thought that crosses my mind into a design. So okay. It's a little bit easier to make a visual representation of what I have just thought. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I ask that because you know, Beth and I have had multiple discussions about changing someone else's design to make it your own colors, mm-hmm. or whatever. And it's a huge hump for people to get over. And then to get to that point where you're creating your own, particularly if you don't have any art training or don't believe yourself to be creative. And then it's, I'm sure there's a lot of just try and throw away. Until you get something that you like.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. There absolutely is. I think that, you know, one of the gifts I was given was to value perseverance. So although it has gotten easier, there definitely is an element of, no, you know, this is what you want it to look like. Keep going. You can make it look this way. It's going to take a lot of, you know, that's why Procreate is great. It's digital. It's a digital art pad, and you can, just like Photoshop and, you know, and a DSLR, you can get rid of the 1,000 terrible pictures you had before you have the one that works easily, you know. And then that work, even if you've thrown it away, you have gotten better. You've gotten more muscle memory. You have flexed, you know, the right side of your brain more and made it more deft at performing the tasks that you want it to. It's, none of it is wasted, yeah. But I think, you know, perseverance definitely plays a part.
Okay, what I'm seeing is, and I know for me it would be, if I were to try to design, it would be a very regimented attempts. And, you know, and to me, to get over the hump would be when it just starts to flow out of you rather than put this down and hope something goes with it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I think that there is some element of, you know, having a process, having a regimented process, though, even if it's directed towards something creative, maybe not for a, you know, quote unquote real artist, but for me, there is an element of that for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think all artists will tell you they have, you know, you've got to make bad art to make good art, is something, you know, that I hear often, or you have to get yourself into the studio and work before you can make any art. You know, if you don't put your paintbrush down in the paint and then put it on the canvas, you're never going to make art. So I think the same thing goes for cross-stitch designers, any designing or doing anything. If you're not willing to put
to fail.
Yes, and put pencil to paper and say, hey, this didn't work, let's try again, then you're never going to succeed, you know?
Yeah. That's definitely true, right? How many shots did Michael Jordan take before he had it perfected?
Right.
Yeah, and that's the part nobody sees.
Mm-hmm.
And when they see good art, no matter what it is, they don't see all the hours of Michael Jordan just clanking it off the rim, you know, and for you, all the files that got trashed.
Yeah.
Before something started to gel. Yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah. So you're with Kathy. I mean, there's a master marketer.
Oh my goodness.
I can imagine that phone call, because what's in her head just about marketing and creating and putting things out that appeal to people. I mean, she is just one of the best by far.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I cannot even begin to express what a treasure she is in general and has been to me in this whole introduction to the industry and getting my feet wet. And yeah, it's, and she's a wonderful woman too. I mean, we've become friends over the last few years as well, but there's no question that she is, I'm not sure I could have found a better mentor, honestly. Yeah. And just so willing to share and be frank and honest. And, you know, in that first conversation that, you know, I'm asking her, oh, you know, okay, so what should I do next? And, you know, what's the, well, you know, maybe you should frame that piece and, you know, take a good picture of it. Okay. That's good feedback.
Yeah, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So the, but the samplers, what's interesting to me is usually in the cross-stitch world, it's reproduction samplers or it's original art. And you have, I would suggest, an equal collection of both. Does one
close,
feed into the other, or are they two separate channels for you?
They are two separate, I think. Maybe, you know, the samplers bring sampler lovers over to the originals and vice versa. That's possible. I like to do both kinds of things, you know, when I was just buying designs. And so that's what I do. I want to reproduce samplers and design the originals that are things that I would want to put in my house. If I came across it on 123 Stitch on their new charts, you know, page, would I go, oh, yes, I have to have that. You know, that's my goal, is that that's the stuff that I'll put out. And for me, that's the stuff that I put out. Yeah. I can't answer whether that scratches anybody else's itch in either direction, you know, but that's my goal. I like a lot of very different things. I like the Dimensions Christmas kits. I love the huge samplers. I love the, you know, Kathy Haberman's ornaments. I love the, who's it? Praiseworthy Stitches, her Christmas designs. So if it's, you know, I just love a lot of different things. And I love to combine different milieus, I guess, with mm-hmm. each other. So, you know, rustic and primitive. I love to put something rustic and primitive with a fancy sterling silver tray or, you know, a busted up piece of crockery with a brass, you know, candle holder. I like mixing those things in my home. And so that's kind of, I kind of want to do that in my designs as well.
Yeah. But a lot of the look you have in your work is more of that primitive style. Is that conscious or is that just the way it works?
No, it really isn't. I would say it's definitely not conscious, and I'm not really sure where it comes from, because I wouldn't say that I generally choose specifically primitive things. It just, if it appeals to my eye, then that's what I'll choose. And, maybe it's a reflection of my skill as an artist, and as I improve, it'll get better and look less prim. I don't know. That remains to be seen, but, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, nothing wrong with primitive. I mean, there's
a lot.
I mean, that stuff is really great in its own little world, and it's just interesting to me that how people gravitate toward that. Mm-hmm. You know, is it because that's the way you like interior design, or is that what your mind sees in terms of art? I don't know, but. It's interesting because the color palette tends to be rather muted and quiet. And, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know what drives that. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's oddly symmetrical. I mean, even though I guess the word primitive is sort of self-explanatory, right? But maybe there's some sort of intrinsic symmetry in it that, although it's rustic and primitive, it still is appealing to that part of our brain that processes visually and says that is good. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea. I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of it, but designers tend to, like if there's a person who does primitive work, they tend to stick in that channel pretty mm-hmm. rigidly. And then people who don't are, the whole color palette is so much different. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's the psychology of it all just fascinates me. It's
agreed. Yes. Yeah. And what makes one thing super appealing to another and be a complete ick for someone else.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and that gets
very
to that,
interesting.
What you hinted at earlier was creating things for you. Cause I think that's mm-hmm. a mistake as an artist that you make, is if you start trying to create things that you think will sell.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it breaks down in fairly short order. You have to create what comes out of you, and then if people like it, fine. If they don't, fine.
I feel that even if I tried, I don't think that I understand the market well enough to have a snowball's chance at predicting what would sell and what wouldn't, because there have definitely been things that I thought would sell like hotcakes that nobody wanted.
Yeah.
And then there's things that I'm like, oh, I don't know, should I even release this? And that people are like, oh my gosh, I love it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that happens. You're not the only one. Yeah.
Yeah. But
there's no predicting, and I think that's where it breaks down, is if you start trying to predict, that you just go down a path that is just not productive for anyone. And you either put things out that people like, or the people that like what you do find you. Either way, but you have to be true to yourself.
Yes. I think if you start producing for the market, it does just become a business, right? It's not a passion anymore, because I don't know about, maybe other people are different, but I can't be passionate about providing what someone else is passionate about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. You've got to love it. I mean, you can even tell it in the samplers you've chosen. I'm looking at Hester Garlic and then Grace Gill. I mean, those two samplers are their colors are so vibrant, and Hester, but I see both of them as very similar because they've got dense stitching.
Mm-hmm.
I could see them next to each other on the wall for some reason. And I'm like, oh yeah, it'd take you forever to stitch those, Beth, but.
Hester is definitely a longer stitch than Grace. They have about the same number of stitches, but Hester is more challenging. There's a little more confetti in her than there is in Grace. And I wish that I had been able to find either of them, but I couldn't.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
But you can see, you kind of love that, because the colors in Hester with the brightness of the it seems like a patriotic eagle in the center, and then with Grace and those griffins up on the top, that are so bright to me. I don't know, there's something about them that I find very appealing. And so did you stitch those yourselves, or do you have a model stitcher?
I did. I do have some model stitchers, but I did stitch Hester and Grace myself. Yeah, I think most of the samplers I have done myself. The posy that's with Charlotte McGillis, that one was stitched by a model stitcher, but for the most part, just the originals go to model stitchers. So, yeah.
What's that experience like? Do you send a clean chart to a model stitcher, and then you start to learn how clean it was?
Yes. Yes. The good ones will say, here's a mistake here. And then I can, as they're stitching, they'll send them to me and I can go and edit the chart as it's being stitched. And, the really good ones will say, hey, this color really looks whack. You need to send me some different yellows to try here because this is not working, because, it looks a little bit different. Even, you pull the one strand and put it on the linen, it still looks different when it's stitched. And, it's a little bit of a crapshoot, but I have one that is very reliably steered me right when I have gotten it wrong.
Yeah.
And that is priceless, absolutely priceless. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Not just finding the little errors, but helping you choose the right colors, because colors change when they're next to each other.
They do. Yes, they do. Mm.
And it's hard to know until you get those stitches in.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
So then you're basically running a local needlework shop in terms of threads, where you've got to keep.
Yes. They, the Classic Colorworks and Weeks and General Arts have been very generous from very early on with providing me with a palette. And then, you know, I send them and I say, these are the ones I used. Here's the chart. And they'll replace it and, you know, send me holes. Sometimes they even send things directly to a stitcher. I'll say, hey, listen, I'm on a tight turnaround. Can you just, I need two skeins of this. Can you just send it straight to my model stitcher? And they have been more than willing and gracious to do that. So that also is a huge help.
Yeah.
For the whole process. Yeah.
Do you try to keep some kind of a planned, steady flow of designs, or does it ebb and flow according to your creative whims?
Well, I try to make sure that I have at least 5 releases for Nashville, 5 for the fall, whether there's a show in the fall or not, and then at least 2 in June and 2 in December. I know other designers do more in June and December, you know, on those off quarters, but given the, you know, my schedule, I don't have the bandwidth to do much more. At this time, I'm trying to add some more model stitchers so that I can, you know, maybe put out a little bit more quantity each year.
Is that the choke point, getting the model stitched?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a backlog of ideas, just can't get them stitched.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Backlog of ideas, a backlog of samplers. Yeah. Which is a good problem to have.
How do you manage that sampler thing? That's got to be a dangerous addiction.
It is. It is. So there are times that I will ban myself from going online and looking at the auctions. You know. But I love the history of them so much, and I love the way they look, and I love finding ones that are unique and don't look like every other sampler out there, but, you know, at least I try. That's what I'm shooting for. But the thing that I love the most about them is the entry point they provide to the history, you know, not just big event history, right? But the history of women and children and the education system and, you know, the economy and how all of those things played together, you know, sociology, socioeconomic factors, what happened when, you know, things became industrialized, what happened when the education system changed, you know, how all of those play into what life was like for everyday girls and women, especially. I mean, obviously, you know, boys as well, you know, I don't, but in particular, because those everyday stories of girls and women are not often told. And I think that when they are, we understand and become a little bit more, I'm not sure exactly what word I'm looking for. It's not that we become more empathetic, but it brings history more alive. And we realize, you know, wow, people then 200 years ago had similar concerns and issues to what I did, maybe a different degree, maybe in a different direction. But, you know, we really are just people and always have been just people. You know, especially you find some of the genealogical information about these women and, or, you know, the girls, and you can trace their lives and see the different things that happen to them. Some of them are just so tragic, and, you know, you think, wow, we are so privileged, where I can't even imagine that happening to anyone here. You know, yeah. What I mean? Like, yeah. Wow. And then there are others, like, one that I recently reproduced, the write-up, I talk about how she started out in as part of a very poor family. A lot of, I think it was like 12 children, I think, maybe not that many. And, you know, they were very poor. Everyone in that household was working. And, but then she ended her life married with children, and she herself employed a servant. And, you know, it's interesting. And that was, you know, middle Victorian period, early middle. Before that, that sort of mobility would never have happened. And so you get the context and, you know, okay, well, how meaningful was that really in the context of what was happening in the wider world? Well, that was actually huge. That is, you know, a perfect example of the way things were changing for people, you know, just the everyday common people, right? That upward mobility was absolutely unheard of before then.
Down
a rabbit hole there.
No, it's interesting because one of my hobbies, and there are multiples, is picking away at restoring Singer sewing machines, the old ones.
Oh yeah.
And I was watching my wife and I were having a conversation the other day where basically I talked and she put up with me, but I had watched a video where a guy was talking about Singer and how he started his company. Mm-hmm. And they talked about how the tailors were all upset with him, all the men tailors, because they thought he was going to take away their business, to the point where a bunch of them got together and burnt down one of his factories.
I think I saw this.
Yeah.
Yes. And, fascinating.
Right. And of course, it didn't happen. But then this guy who was telling this story pointed out that everything Singer did, all of his marketing involved women.
Mm-hmm.
And how he basically changed the whole clothing making business with these machines that people could afford, and marketing to women, and effectively empowering them to to use needle and thread. And, you know, I mean, Beth and I have had conversations with all kinds of people who have studied how thread and needle have played a role throughout history. And if you really look at it, it's a huge role that needle and thread play, and even up to today. And it's we don't have a full appreciation for what two simple little objects can do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. Be it utilitarian, decorative. Yeah, it's symbolic. You know. It's it should be the needle is mightier than the sword.
Well, there's some truth to that, yeah. But I mean, yeah, he created these sewing machines, and then you could pay for them. What you had, you could take it, pay what you wanted. You just had to pay it off in 20 years. And
20 years, wow! Yeah,
but no interest, no anything. Just take it. And so then he enabled women to create clothing for their families. And the first machine that I restored was called the farmer's machine by many, because it was built strong enough that it could sew just about anything you'd encounter on a farm. And well, that's empowering if you're out in the middle of nowhere and you need to repair things. And he made it affordable. And, you know, just imagine what that did for people. And
oh my goodness. Yes.
Yeah.
Time savings alone,
right,
being
right.
able to repair, you know, clothing or blankets or, just being able to repair those things yourself rather than taking a long trip into town and, you know, the time cost and actual cost of taking it and giving it to someone else to repair. Yeah, that's huge.
Yep. Yeah, I don't think we appreciate today. We just throw stuff out and get new, but wasn't an option then. And for many, even today, it's not an option. And to be able to repair and create new it's amazing what needle and thread, what it does. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to run out of time, and I got to learn about, you have one punch needle design that you show. And it's pretty sophisticated from what little I know about punch needle. Is that a pick at it kind of channel for you, or is that something?
I have one design that is almost ready to go, and I am just sort of exploring how exactly I want to present those designs. I'm not really sure, you know, do I want to only do them in paper? Do I want to only do them in PDF? Is that, I'm not really sure I want to do anything only PDF anymore. You know, so if you do it in PDF, so that one, it's available only on my website. I don't print that one out. And one of the advantages of presenting a punch needle pattern as a PDF is, you know, you can, so I have a very detailed picture of the back in color. So it's a scanned picture of the back of the punch needle. So you can very specifically see where to place the stitches if you want, you know, if you want that level of guidance. And that's significantly more expensive to do in paper. But I don't want there to be an advantage for PDF versus someone who buys it in paper. So I'm just kind of, I actually have a call with a shop owner fairly soon to discuss this kind of stuff. But I have ideas. Yes, I have a lot of ideas. It's just a matter of how.
Yeah.
How do I make it happen? Yeah. I really love punch needle. It's so fun and so fast. And, yeah, I really, really like it. And I think that there are some things, like I have some antique needlework that really does, personally, I don't think it would lend itself very well to being translated, you know, into a modern cross-stitch pattern. But I think they would be fantastic as a punch needle pattern. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
How are you navigating that? It's a real changing market in terms of downloadable PDFs, local mm-hmm. needlework stores, selling off your website. How are mm-hmm. you navigating that? Just providing to all fronts or?
Mm-hmm.
What's
do.
What's that like
so,
for you?
It's actually very good. And when I initially started, I was pretty certain that I was only going to sell PDF on Etsy. Well, that quickly went. I shut down my Etsy shop very quickly and started my own website pretty quickly. And then Kathy convinced me, no, you need to like get your stuff into shops. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll give it a shot. And so then, you know, we went out into paper. And so, yeah, so now I sell PDFs only on my website. And then the paper charts are available through the shops. And I do have two distributors, Hoffman and Yarn Tree, both distribute my patterns to shops. It is a shifting marketplace, and it's really interesting that you say that, Gary, because I was in one of the meetings at Market, and then just listening to different shop owners talk, you know, as they were in my room, maybe waiting, and it seems like there are and I could be completely wrong. It seems like there's two camps, the shops that absolutely do not appreciate, well, maybe three camps, the shops that don't appreciate that designers are selling as a PDF, the shops, then you have the shops, you know, they feel like it's taking away their chart sales from the paper charts. Well, if somebody buys a PDF, maybe they're not going to buy a paper chart. And then there's the shops that are fine with it. They don't feel like it takes away anything because after all, the person still has to come buy supplies, even if they don't buy the chart. And then there's the shops that are like, well, why won't you let me sell your PDFs?
Oh.
So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where it all levels out with that, you know?
Yeah.
So.
No, it's difficult to know because we need local needlework shops. I mean, I think we all would agree.
Oh, yes.
That, yeah, they must
yes.
exist. And now that Joann's couponed themselves into bankruptcy.
Oh, my goodness. Michael's is probably soon to follow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't tear me up because I think people should buy their floss at local needlework stores rather than Joann's, but, you know, just to support the cause, but.
Yeah,
you know, it's interesting how that plays out because it is real easy to do PDFs, and you know, you can make the argument ecologically, or it's you can download a PDF and you're not killing trees, but I know I like to have the paper in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to stitch off of a screen. So,
well, and I'll be super honest. Most of the time when I buy a PDF, it's because I want it right that second. But then a month later or a couple weeks later, I'll be like, yeah, I really want my hands on the paper copy too, so I'm going to buy that too. Like, I usually end up buying both. It is not an economically feasible strategy. No. I would not recommend it.
Well, and I think that is the appeal of PDFs, is that people can, you know, get them right away. They don't have to wait. It's appealing for people who live overseas, who you've got all the extra tariffs if you order a physical chart. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. So there's, I can see the appeal of a PDF, but I'm like, Gary, I'm going to print it out anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think that, and I think young people like stitching off the screen because you can mark it off. There's, I shouldn't just say young people because there's people who don't mind using a tablet or whatever to stitch. I just can't. I can't get my brain around it. And I know my kids would laugh at me, but for me, I need that physical chart. But I see the appeal of it. I do see the appeal.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, yeah. Well, and for me, I can do both, and I do both. For, you know, my son will have some homeschool activities where it's far enough away that I'm not going to drive home. And, you know, so I have a couple of hours to kill. So I'll sit in the car, pop on an audiobook or some music. And then in those circumstances, having a bunch of paper is just too much. So then I'll have the chart on my phone or on my tablet, and, you know, marking it off there. But I like both. I love I'm kind of tactile. I like the feel of the paper and, you know, marking with an actual pencil. And it's a whole experience for me.
Right.
And you just don't get that with the PDF, with the electronic.
Oh, I miss those days of, you get so much stitching time when you were waiting for piano lesson to be over. And you had I had an hour and a half with all three kids taking piano. It's like, oh, lots of stitching time.
It feels sort of indulgent, didn't it?
Right, like
your own little escape. Yes.
I mean, but you couldn't go anywhere. I mean, I live far enough away. I was like, I couldn't go shopping or go home. That would be a waste of gas.
Oh, yeah, so get home and come right back. Yeah.
Right. No, absolutely not.
Oh, it's a real shame. I've got to bring my stitching so I have something to do.
Yeah.
Oh, darn. Yep.
Oh, darn. Rad. I'll get some model stitching done.
No, too bad.
All right, we got to wrap this thing up. Robin, what's next? We got new designs. No, market just ended, but a couple designs coming out soon.
Yeah, yep, two or three for the summer, and then a bunch in the fall. There's a couple of exclusives in the fall that I'm not sure I can talk about, so I won't. And then, yeah, rolling right into market next year. Yeah, so I've got a bunch of samplers coming out. I've got a couple of samplers out, model stitched right now. An original is about ready to go out, and then there'll be a couple more ready to go out. Yeah, we're just rolling. I'm trying to get ahead of the curve a little bit so that, you know, when life happens and there's not much time to dedicate to the business, I'm not left scrambling and behind.
Yeah. Well, and I've got to ask one more question. So what was your bestseller for Nashville market?
Straighten Your Crown.
The little pillow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. That, and then Grace Gill was number two. Yeah. Yep. I've already had to do a reprint of both of them, which is fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's great. And the Straighten Your Crown, I saw that one. That was a cute little design.
It's just a fun little, and again, that was one that, you know, was inspired by a conversation. Somebody had been saying, you know, talking about women straightening each other's crowns. And then my daughter and I were talking, and she's like, well, you know, I have good girlfriends, but usually I want to just straighten my own crown. And I was like, yes, you do. That would be a great design.
Into the little book it goes. Yep.
Yep, exactly.
Yep. All right, Robin, thanks so much for doing this. It's littlerobindesigns.net. Note the .net.
Yes.
littlerobindesigns.net, and also on Instagram. Wow, great stuff, Robin. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really nice talking to you both. I really enjoyed it.
Yep. We did too, right. And thanks to everyone for listening.
All right, thank you. Have a great week.